For this evening's talk, I'm going to be talking about a subject I hope I've never talked about before, although that's unlikely, seeing as I've been speaking here for over 20 years. And it's come up in the newspapers recently, and a few people have been discussing this on the email, because apparently just before Easter time there was an atheist conference over in Sydney, and that really upset some people. In the churches in Sydney, and because they were talking about atheism, and it affects Buddhism, because is Buddhist an atheistic religion? Does it believe in a God? If it doesn't, why doesn't it? And what is the Buddhist position about this? And the first part of this talk, you know, maybe just a bit of information about the Buddhist stand on a God, and some interesting things which many of you may not know, but the most important part of this talk is that actually, as far as Buddhism is concerned, it's better if one does not believe in a supernatural being, because there are some very, very grave consequences of such a belief in your ordinary life. So I'm going to take the Buddhist view and point out that actually that you can become a wiser, more compassionate person without such beliefs, which can sometimes obstruct, you know, one's feeling of what's right and what's compassionate. But let's go from the very beginning. That sometimes people ask, you know, is Buddhism an atheistic religion? What is a Buddhist take on a God? But first of all, just to go to the ancient scriptures, 2,500 years ago, when the Buddha was around, you know, of course he mentioned just the idea of a God, which was very common at that time. And as far as the Buddha was concerned, it wasn't just a theory, but because of these great powers which you can get through meditation, you understand just how this universe works and just how sort of a God can come into being. But the idea of like a what we call like a creator God, in other words, someone who starts this universe going, was something which was just not really sort of important for Buddhism, because as far as people who could meditate were concerned, by developing the mind in such powerful states of mind, not only you can recollect past lives, but not one, but many. And sometimes those lives go back a long, long time. In other words, before this universe began, to the previous one. So even this, you know, was when I first read this, this was like astounding. 2,500 years ago, the Buddha was saying, yeah, he recollected 96 eons, that's 95 big bangs, which was quite astounding. Why 96? That's just what he could remember. Because what actually happens when you develop in meditation, you understand what this mind is. And I've mentioned this to you before, but this is an experience which you can have for yourself. You understand how independent this mind is from the body. Not just this body, but from the physical plane as well. And from Buddhism, we've always had those six senses, you know, the five senses of the body and the mind, which is independent, not as if the mind is some sort of byproduct of having a brain and somehow contingent on this material world, but totally independent. If anything, this material world is contingent on the brain. And certainly that was something which came up when I was a physicist, and especially, you know, really understanding some of the great things like quantum physics, to see just the effect the mind has on this world. And you can say, and it's a valid way of saying, that your mind actually does create the world in a much more powerful, direct sense than people think. It's not the way we just imagine it, but we can actually create things with our mind. And seeing that the mind is sort of independent of this world, as far as Buddhist cosmology, our big, not world view, but not even universe view, but multi-universe views, is that this mind is totally independent. And so, if the body dies, the mind can still carry on. Even if this universe disappears, the mind can still carry on. And it carries on in those realms which you can access in this very body, the jhana realms. Those people who access these deep states of meditation where the mind is so still, you can't feel the body disappears, there's no senses there, people can talk to you, you just don't can't hear, they can have an explosion, you just don't listen to it, just five senses are turned off. You're in the realm of the mind, and that's that realm which people can access when there's no other place to go, when the physical realm disappears. Okay, so this jhana realm is something which you have the experience, it gives you another understanding of just of what this mind is, and just how, as the Buddha said in his first verse of the Dhammapada, it is much more powerful than anything else. It's the chief. Worlds come and go, but the mind is not really disturbed by the coming and going of this universe. I'm not talking about some God mind, I'm talking about your mind. And in very, very, very deep meditation, you can understand that, not as a belief, as a truth. So this gives a bit of a world view of many eons coming and going, many big bangs. And the last time I checked out what physicists were doing, was Professor Epstein, of, I think it was UCLA, was also just proposing not sort of a multiple universes, but a serial universes, one after the other after the other. And of course, it makes logical sense. If you had one Big Bang, why not another? It's really weird to just have one Big Bang, just one. Why not two? Why not three? Why not many? Why not whole serial universes? Goes on and on and on and on. And to me, that's just so beautiful. Not only beautiful, but it gives more of an idea of just what the Buddha actually taught. So in those serial universes, you know, where is an idea of a creator God? And these ancient suttas, if ever you actually look at them, one of the things they actually mentioned there was that there is a being. This is in the Buddha suttas, who assumes he is the creator God. I actually shouldn't say he, because it's an it. This is in Buddhism, not a he, not a she, but an it. And there's a reason for that, which I'll say in a few moments. And it assumes it's a god. And the reason is because it was once this universe, one of many, was formed. It was the first mind, if you like, which actually descended from those jhana realms into this universe in which we are now sitting. The first being. Yeah, there is a first being. When everything is created, there's always a first person who moves into a house. So it. And of course, it descended from a jhana realm. Those jhana realms, there's no gender. It's only when you have bodies and things you can have a gender. For that God is an it. Not a girl, not a boy, but an it. Okay. And there's a reason for that, because it's not material. Okay. And so that descended, and because it had no memory at all about where it came from, it just came into this universe, descended to it, was the very first, and so other people came in afterwards, they thought it was the chief, the first, the creator. And according to some of the suttas, you know, the Buddha actually went up to the realm where God existed. Now this, no, not creator God, but the being who thinks is God. They call it Mahabrahma, Mahabrahma in Buddhism. And actually taught it, no, Mahabrahma, you know, there's other beings there before you. You forgot, okay? You're not the creator. You're not the firstborn. It's just you're part of this whole series. And the Buddha could do that because, you know, it had those great recollections. And interestingly, this was, you know, suttas in Buddhism. If any of you are interested in just, you know, the ancient teachings, look up what we call the Nag Hammadi Library, which was the teachings of the Gnostic Christianity. Early Christianity had three streams. It had a Jewish Christianity, which was destroyed, and just another branch of Judaism, destroyed in 70 AD with the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem by the Romans. And that left two strands of Christianity, the one which was centered in Rome, and the one which was not centered anywhere, called the Gnostic Christianity, which had no hierarchy, total freedom. Everybody was, you know, their own wise person. No priests, no bishops. And it was a very, very loose, and you know, what we'd even call today modern type of Christianity, because it didn't have any hierarchy or any organization. It was very easily destroyed by the Roman Church, which gained presidency, and that's the only church we know. Of course, when they gained presidency over the Gnostics, they tried to destroy all of their scriptures. But when you try to destroy things, I'm not quite sure why this happens, but it's always the law, there's always some things survive. And in about 1945, some archaeologists who were in southern Egypt, close to the town of Nag Hammadi, saw somebody burning these ancient papyruses on their fire just to get to make their meal, and realized these were very ancient, and found out these were, again, discovered in a cave. These were old teachings from the first century AD of the Gnostic Christian Church, and had some amazing teachings in there, which is so close to Buddhism. Things like, If you know the truth of yourself, you know the truth of all things, said Jesus Christ in the Gnostic Gospels. Wow. Have you ever heard that one before? But interestingly, they also have, this is a Gnostic Christianity, okay? First century of our common era. There they have their God in heaven saying, I am the firstborn, the chief, the powerful, the all-powerful. And then he hears a voice, no, you're not, there are other beings much superior than you. Who said that? I don't know who said that. Who was that who said that? Now that is actually Gnostic Christianity. Also showing that, you know, the being who takes themselves to be a God is not the all-powerful, that's a delusion. There is no creator God, this universe comes. And that's, as far as a physicist is concerned, there's no need for a creator God. As far as physics is concerned, and that's probably the most logical of the sciences, and the most hard of the sciences, you know, the most evidence-based, there is no need for a creator God. This universe can very easily evolve without one. It's not necessary for someone actually to press the button to start the universe. Basically, the law is it can happen, it will happen, and it has happened many, many times. So that was the case of a Buddha's idea of a God. Yes, there's a being there, it's a deluded being, but it is not a creator. Powerful, yes, but not all-powerful. And certainly because of not all-powerful and because of still a deluded being, like the other beings in the universe, still subject to anger, can be very kind, but not all the time. Just another being like any other in this universe, but more very powerful. And the nice thing about that is that it shows that all the beings in this universe, doesn't matter where they're born, now, they're all basically similar in their sense of they when they have an ego or self, you know, we get angry sometimes, we're sometimes kind, just like you and me. So it's an ordinary being in this universe. And that was actually the position sort of Buddhism with a God. So we always call it a God with a small g, not a creator God, not an all-powerful God. And that actually solves a lot of the problems, you know, for many people. Because it was, I think it was Saint Augustine, this is now quoting Christianity, who once said, look, the idea of like a creator, all-powerful, all-loving God is totally logical, because if they're all-powerful, they can't be all-loving. If they're all-loving, they can't be all-powerful. Why? Because there's suffering. If there's suffering, if there was all-powerful and all-loving, why didn't they do something about it? And it's one of the obvious concerns, and which a lot of times people lose their faith in an all-powerful, all-loving God, because you just have cancer, or you see your mother with dementia, or you have, you know, see earthquakes, you see sort of tsunamis, you see, or just the ordinary pain in this life, kids with cancer, or kids dying. So why does that happen? And this was 1,500 years ago, they said, well, look, if there is a God which is all-powerful, he's obviously not kind. Because if it's all-powerful, he could do something, but doesn't. You know, if they are all kind and all-powerful, they want to do something, but they can't. It's a great little argument. But in Buddhism, we put that aside, because that is a person. Now, some years ago, that's just giving you some background of canonically, or sort of theoretically, according to, you know, Buddhism in the suttas, what actually God is defined as. But to take this to a much, much better level, at a conference, an interfaith conference, it was actually for chaplains some years ago. There I was giving a session together with the late good friend Abbot Placid from the Benedictine Monastery in Eunorcia. You know, he died last year, and he became a good friend. We did lots of stuff together. In fact, that one person said that, you know, we had so much fun together, we were like Morecambe and Wise, we should do a roadshow together throughout Australia, because he had a good sense of humour, I had a good sense of humour, we actually bounced off each other. But we were doing this little, and he was outrageous sometimes. For example, one thing which, you know, one of my abiding memories is at this conference, somebody asked him, he said, look, I'm a chaplain, sort of in a university over in the East. He said, it's so easy, he said, as a Christian chaplain to work with other Christians, with the Buddhists, with the Muslims, with the Jews, with the Hindus, but the people we find it so hard to deal with is the evangelical Christians, you know, the born-agains. And he said to Abbot Placid, can you give me some advice on what to do with the evangelical Christians? And without missing a beat, Abbot Placid, a Benedictine Catholic abbot, said, "Take them out." It was the way he said it, just people burst out laughing. Here's an abbot saying, "Take them out." And I said, "What do you mean, to kill them?" He said, no, take them out one by one. Take them outside by themselves and talk to them one by one. Because when they're in a group, they support each other and it's hopeless. Individually, you can actually get through to them. But the same point, I think it was actually the fellow is quite well known, Frank Brennan. I think he's quite a sort of famous sort of, I think he's a Jesuit, I think it's based over East. And he asked me this question just afterwards. He said, "What's the Buddhist idea of a God?" And so I took it deeper, than just, quoting your scriptures. And I said, "Well, look, the fellow sitting next to me, Abbot Placid, I've known him for such a long time. And we have these great discussions about Buddhism and Christianity and spiritual stuff. And I really respect him. I never look down upon him." And I said, "One thing which he once, not told me once, but used to tell me many, many times. He said, one of his core beliefs, one of his things which drove him throughout his life was the realization," he said, "that everybody was searching for God." Now that's what he said. Now I respect this guy. So I said, "Let's take that statement from someone I respect. So what was I searching for? What are you searching for? What are people actually searching for in life?" What people are searching for in life, is truth, meaning, love, peace, kindness. Isn't that what you're coming here for? What sort of drives you in your life? The search for truth, love, peace, contentment. He said, "Well, if this fellow sitting next to me said everyone is searching for God, and this is what people are searching for, then that's what God must mean." So in Buddhism, I said, God means peace, love, contentment, fulfillment. I said, you call that God? And I said, yeah, I believe in that. And I think Father Frank Brennan was actually quite happy and satisfied with that. He said, that was an answer which was meaningful. So as far as Buddhism is concerned, if it's like a creator God, if it's an all-powerful God, no way. That was even the Buddha sort of denied that. But if you have the impersonal God, just what I've said, the things which you exist, sometimes you touch them. Sometimes you touch beautiful acts of kindness. Now where there is love, sometimes you see like a mother's love for a child, or you see a cat sort of go into a burning house to save its kittens. Or you see people sacrifice themselves just out of kindness. I'm not talking about sacrificing their lives. I mean sacrificing your time, going to a friend who really needs your help, even though you're going to sacrifice much happiness, much of your time, may get into trouble with the people in your work. You just decide you're going to stop for a while and help someone. You see acts like that, and that's beauty, that's truth, that's kindness. There's something holy about that. And that's what you might call as God. I remember the monks, when they first went to England, telling me this old story. They said that once when they first went to England, they were staying in this old house in Hampstead. Now these were forest monks who lived in big jungle monasteries where you could walk and there was nature, there was animals, some animals you didn't like mosquitoes, but there was just, you had a sense of freedom and it was bright and it was warm and it was lovely. And now they were transported to England in the winter time when it was grey, when it was raining. And there was never even rain properly, it's called drizzle, it's not really raining, not being dry, it's just halfway in between, can't do anything sort of fully. And just everything was so grey and dull in that place. I'm not going to tell the old grey joke, I've said that too many times, but everything is grey and boring and dull and depressing. And one of the monks was looking through the window one morning, feeling very sort of homesick for the jungles and brightness of Thailand. And he saw just in the early morning, drizzle, cold, he saw a homeless man who was hunched in a doorway, trying to escape the worst of the cold and the rain. And I used to know those people. These are people who would overcome the cold of the night by taking the cheapest form of alcohol, which was, you know, methylated spirits, wood spirits in the United States. And it ruins your health. I mean, it kills your liver. But I know many people like that, the meth drinkers, and they stank. And he saw that morning this English gentleman, you know, traditional, apparently you don't have this anymore, bowler hat, you know, furled umbrella, nice suit and an overcoat, going to work in the city. The sort of, you know, person you used to see on the movies a long time ago. Apparently they don't exist anymore. But well-dressed, well-groomed, on his way to work. And he saw this gentleman in his very clean clothes stop at that doorway and just bend over to that homeless man who'd been out all night. He couldn't hear what was said, but he saw next this man in his beautiful suit put his arm around that homeless man, that stinky, dirty man, and gently pick him up and take him to a cafe to get some breakfast. And he said that in that moment, the greyness and the coldness and the dullness of London just vanished. It was beautiful. He saw an act which uplifted him, an act of kindness and care, because that man would have the smell on his clothes as he went to work. He'd probably be late. But he said, it doesn't matter what my boss says. There was a person who needed some kindness, needed some food, needed a friend. It doesn't matter if I'm late. It doesn't matter if I kept the smell on my clothes. It can be washed off later. It was worth doing, an act of kindness. Now you can call that God, if you like. You can call that an act of beauty. And then I can say, yeah, I believe in that. And that's, if you like, the God of the Buddhists. Not a sort of a person, but a principle. This very beautiful thing, which then we can say, yes, we can worship that. And that's something which is actually practical. Because you find if you just worship a being up in the sky, there are consequences which are quite negative to your life. If anybody is interesting, I remember Ajahn Sujata sent me this article many years ago. There was a sociologist in the United States called Gregory Paul who used publicly available data, you know, for the United States and Europe and Canada as well. Because he could actually find out the number of, like, God believers in a sort of little jurisdiction. And that was easily available. Also can find out the murder rate, the number of suicides, abortions, rapes, robberies in that area too. He wanted to correlate to see, divorces were there as well, to see these indicators of social malaise and also to correlate them with how many people believed in God. Now, I'm talking about the Creator God. And he actually found a negative correlation, much to the annoyance of many of the churchgoers, especially the leaders, that the more people believed in a God, the higher the incidence of divorces, child pregnancies, abortions, rapes, murders. Totally against just what people say. They said, because you don't believe in God, that's the reason why there's so many problems in the world. Actually, the opposite was the case. You can check it for yourself. Gregory Paul was the name. I'm sure you can find it on the internet, his research. But what was interesting to me was, why? Why is it the case that if a person believes in an all-powerful Creator God, why does that actually lessen one's ethical standards? And as a Buddhist, as a meditator, as a person who's been in this business a long time, I understand exactly why. It's because when you give responsibility for your actions to some higher power, it means you're not taking that responsibility yourself. You're leaving it for somebody else to pick up the mess after you. And as Buddhists, we don't have that at all. Of maybe all the religions, we take the most responsibility for ourselves and our actions. And that's what the law of karma does. It puts it right back on us. And we just can't get someone else to say, please up there, forgive me. Please up there, I can go to church and I can give all the donations and that's all I need to go to heaven. I don't know if you've heard this story, but there was a person who he went to church every Sunday and he gave donations. He even kept the Ten Commandments, and when he died he went up to heaven and he saw God. And he thought that Jesus would be sitting next to God. And who did he see sitting next to God? A cleaning lady with a mop and a bucket and a duster. He said, what's it? I thought Jesus was going to sit next to God. And the first said, no, didn't we tell you? Cleanliness is next to godliness. That's today's joke. Cleaning lady next to God, cleanliness next to God. Okay. Okay. So, as Buddhists, we actually take responsibility for what we do. Because that means that it just coming to the temple, going to a church, giving donations, that is not enough. And you know that's not enough. Sometimes, though, that people believe priests, they believe monks, they believe the books, and it's just such a relief, isn't it, to feel, oh, I don't need to be good. All I need to do is to go to church, believe in Jesus, believe in Muhammad, believe in somebody or other, and then it all be okay. That is one of the reasons why people don't take responsibilities. And why I think that, now that particular piece of research done by Gregory Paul was a powerful piece of research which confirms what you should really understand. In order to have an ethical, a good society, we have to take responsibility ourselves. We can't just give that responsibility off to some big God. We can't even give that responsibility up to our government to be good. We have to do it ourselves, even if it's like global warming. It's a waste of time waiting for the government to sort of pass some emissions trading scheme or any other sort of restrictions on our use of dirty energy. We have to do it ourselves. Of course, it's obvious. But sometimes the human being, we like some bigger person to take responsibility for us, whether it's a government, whether it's a church, or whether it's some big, you know, myth of a God in the sky. You know, it means that we don't take responsibility for ourselves. And that is a great danger with a belief in a creator God. But if we have the other idea, the belief in like truth and love and kindness, of course, that would make us much more responsible people. We'd actually start to be more kind, to create more peace, to be more gentle, even to be more forgiving. I mentioned this recently just at our monastery when somebody came up and said, no, well, whatever I've done, I ask forgiveness of you. And they'd been meditating long enough and said, that's a waste of time, you shouldn't ask forgiveness of me. And anyway, you know, some of you, you know, you've come to our retreats, you've come up to me, and I've already told you, look, I give you forgiveness in the three time zones. I give you forgiveness for anything you've ever done in the past. I give you forgiveness for what you're doing now. And I give each one of you in this room forgiveness for whatever you might do in the future. Until the end of this eon, until the end of 100 eons, you're pre-forgiven. You've got blank check. Go for it. You're pre-forgiven. Now, I do that as a bit of a joke because I know it won't work anyway if I forgive you or don't forgive you. The most important person to get forgiveness from is yourself. That's the only person who can really forgive you and solve the problem. Taking responsibility again. So going up and you've done something bad, God forgive me, God forgive me, God forgive me, Jesus forgive me, Jesus forgive me, Ajahn Brahm forgive me, Ajahn Brahm forgive me, someone forgive me. You know that might give you a temporary sort of relief from the suffering. But it's only temporary. Because in the end, there's only one person who can forgive you. There's only one person can free you. And you know that's yourself. That's why eventually that forgiveness, it's the external ceremony, it has to come back onto you. Forgive yourself. To say, whatever I've done, by body, speech or mind, whatever it is that I've done, intentional or unintentional, deliberate or just an accident, I forgive me. That's holy. That gives incredible sense of peace and freedom. And also, as I keep on saying, that means you do not do the same thing again. The blank check, once it's given to you, is never written on. It's not, oh yeah, he's here this evening. Once, a few months ago, I gave this talk on generosity. And I said that one of the most wonderful acts of generosity is, wouldn't it be wonderful if a person, because sometimes you give things expecting something back in return, as I said last week about real giving. Sometimes one person actually, I said on one talk, even actually not even saying how much you're going to give, let me decide, give me a blank check. And one person who's sitting here today gave me a blank check, signed, and I could put whatever amount I wanted on it. He said, put whatever you want on it, the blank check. Isn't that wonderful? And of course, you know what I did? I kept it for a couple of months, and then I gave it back to him. And said, you can put whatever you like on it, not me. Because blank checks are like that. I'm not talking about sort of, you know, the blank bank check. The blank checks of forgiveness. Son, daughter, friend, whatever you do, the door of my heart's always open to you. Me, whatever I do, the door of my heart's open to me. I give total forgiveness. You find that blank check is never abused. That type of forgiveness actually frees. It actually means you don't do that act ever again. You don't need to misbehave. You don't need to be angry, to be selfish anymore. And the reason why people are unethical, the reason why they make mistakes, that lack of sensitivity to themselves and others, is overcome. And it's obvious psychology when you sort of get your head around it. Punishment does not work. It just makes people either misunderstand why am I punished? Why is that done? They don't understand the reason for it. And they keep on making mistakes again and again and again. We all know the prison system is a revolving door. You send a person to prison and they get released again, they go back again. Why? It's because they haven't understood about forgiveness. You teach a person forgiveness in jail, they never go back to prison again. You forgive yourself, and then you're free. And you become a far more ethical, kind, compassionate being. If you have the wisdom and compassion to forgive yourself, you're going to have the wisdom and compassion to forgive others. You don't get mean on them anymore. You don't want to seek revenge. You've got enough compassion, you don't even get angry at other people. Of course. Can't you see the logic? Can't you see the sense? So that type of forgiveness we have to give ourselves. We don't ask from a Jesus, from a God, for anything. But if you try to rely on somebody else to solve that problem, it'll just go on and on and on. There'll be never any solution. So one of the important things of pushing aside the reliance on another being is one learns that self-reliance, but not even just the self-reliance in one's ethics, even the self-reliance on one's wisdom. One of the biggest problems with a God, especially a creator God, is means what a creator God means infallible, which means whatever they say must be the truth. And so we have all these books and all these teachings, maybe a book, it may be some teaching. Have you ever gone to these channelers? These people who channel these supernatural beings. Okay, there's maybe actually channeling some being somewhere in the universe, but it doesn't mean that what that being says is absolute truth and can be relied upon. Just because, you know, you see this in a trance, it doesn't mean that it's not rubbish. So tell anybody just whatever is written in a book, whatever comes from a person in a trance, whatever comes from any other person, don't just believe it because it's supernatural. I remember another story. Here comes another joke. About this person and he channeled this powerful being. And this powerful being gave him all this advice, and the guy said, well, look, it's nice having advice, but what I really want is some cash. Okay, said this powerful being, go to the casino. So he went to the casino, and the powerful being said, go to the roulette table. So he went to the roulette table, and this being said, he could hear it in his ear, it was just channeling it. He said, put $10 on number 19. And the wheel went around, and the ball sat on number 19. Put all your winnings on number 22, said the being, and he could hear it in his ear. He put all the winnings on number 22, and the ball went in, number 22. Put all the winnings, he said, on number 16. And he put all the winnings on number 16. And the ball went round and it fell in number 17. And he heard the being say, shit. So even powerful beings make mistakes sometimes. And when they make mistakes, just like you, they swear as well. So the moral of that story, you can't trust even what you hear from supernatural beings sometimes. Everyone makes mistakes, even supernatural beings, so you know, cut them a bit of slack. So, what that really means is you can't trust what's in books. This is one of the other things. As soon as you have a supernatural being, you have an absolute truth. And that has caused so many problems, I mean big problems, wars, oppression, and huge amounts of pain in our history, and I don't need to explain that to you, to describe that to you. I remember talking to one of my friendly rabbis once, and I said, what happens in your holy scriptures if something is written there from an infallible, all-powerful, all-wise God, which really goes against what you believe is compassionate and true? Which one would you choose to follow? Your all-powerful, omniscient God who's written this in some sort of book, or your heart? And of course, you know, that causes a huge amount of problems to people who follow faith and belief in an all-powerful God. Because part of believing in a God means believing that what's attributed to that God must be absolute truth. And most people come across that contradiction, not just once, but many times in their life. What they read in that book is not what they know in their heart. This is something I mentioned last week. If you're going to write anything on a piece of paper and put it in your office or in your bedroom, write this down. Never allow knowledge, especially what's written in books, to stand in the way of truth. Truth is what you know in your heart. It's not written in any book. It doesn't come from a God. It doesn't come from some infallible pope or from some all-wise Ajahn Brahm. It does not come from me. It comes from you. So don't read the books. Read your heart. Don't trust any infallible authority. Trust your wisdom, your compassion, what you know is right. And if you can do that, you'll be a very wise and effective and ethical person. Well, it was a nice anecdote about that. This is a good one. It was about last year sometimes. There was it must have been the 25th anniversary of the... No, it must be about the 40th or 50th, 40th anniversary... No, 50th anniversary of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. I remember that because... No, 40th or something... anniversary of this terrible event in the Vietnam War, because, you know, I was growing up at this time, protesting against that war as a student. I remember that a group of American soldiers were ordered to go into this village of My Lai to kill every man, woman and child. No one was an exception. And that is just evil. That's wrong. And they went into this village to kill. And this documentary was tracing the soldiers who had participated in that event. And all those people, even though they were given pardons by the American government, the very fact that that's what they did had caused huge psychological and social problems. And you've gone in and actually killed like just a mother. You know, you've shot a kid, you know, 5 or 6 year old. Even though you were ordered to do that, like these huge scars. And you pay for that. You can't have a relationship, you can't sort of have good health, you can't have happiness. But there was one soldier, there's always one or two who stand out. It was a black African soldier who refused. He refused the order to go in and kill, you know, what he thought was, you know, women and children. They've got nothing to do with the war. He refused the order. He knew what would happen. He was put in military jail for 3 or 4 years for refusing to obey an order. Military jails in the United States in that 60s, 70s were far worse than civilian jails. And I think many of you know what civilian jails are like in the United States. And it's totally different than sort of jails here in Perth today. That was a very tough place, a very painful place to be for 3 or 4 years. And he knew what he was doing. By refusing the order, he knew this was the consequence. But he had to do it. And he endured those 3 or 4 years. But of all the people, he was the only person who had a life, who was happy and at peace with himself. And when the interviewer asked him, so I was told, how come you did that? How come you refused an order while all your fellows, your friends, your comrades, went in there and killed? And you knew what was going to happen to you. Why did you do that? He says, simply because I knew it was wrong. I just had to follow what my heart told me. And that's, I did that, I had to. And that's what we call ethical strength. It's not because what the book says. You follow the book and it says you have to follow orders. It's not your fault. It's the colonel's fault, the general's fault. But you know it's your fault. That degree of ethics, you know in your heart what's right and what's wrong. And I mention that to many Buddhists when they give me these ethical dilemmas. Should you have the abortion, euthanasia, or any other ethical problems which you face in life? How are you going to solve those dilemmas? What choice are you going to make? Or rather, how do you make that choice? Please don't look at the books. Please don't ask me. Don't try and find some authority somewhere to give you that answer. Look in your heart. Ask yourself that question. This is where that truth lies. But if you believe in an authority, in a God, you're going to make some terrible decisions. And this is one of the reasons why that Gregory Paul found out that people who just gave that decision-making to God were usually more unethical and created more social problems for themselves and their community. But people who know the answer for themselves, look in their heart like that black African soldier did. He knew it was wrong. Don't do it. So you find that the so-called atheists who don't trust sort of, you know, some revealed teaching or some authority except for what they can know in their own heart, they are the people who usually make the correct ethical decisions. They follow law of karma and they reap the results, a happier, more peaceful life for themselves and for other people as well. So, what that really means is that don't believe in an authority God which is outside a supernatural being. But please believe in truth, in kindness, in contentment, in compassion. And you don't have to go to theologians and say, does that type of God exist? You know, what actually is it? You know, is God a man or a woman? Is it an it? Is it sort of Caucasian, African? What a lot of rubbish that is. But love, kindness, compassion, peace, these are things which you can touch, which you can know for yourself in this very life. That's what you should believe in. That's what you should rely on. That is what we go to to find the answers, not just to our ethical questions, but to the meaning of our life. It gives us directions, it gives us meaning, it supplies us with wisdom. It's what we worship. So when people say, as a monk, what do you worship? Yeah, I worship the Buddha. But the Buddha is a symbol. The symbol of, you know, what I said a few weeks ago, when I bow to a Buddha, I bow to virtue, peace, wisdom, sometimes compassion instead of wisdom. The two go together. The three bows, the first one to virtue, the first one to peace, the last one to compassion or wisdom. Because that's what I believe in. That's what I worship. So every time I remember that, I actually increase my virtue, I increase my peace, I increase my compassion and wisdom, because that's what happens. Every time you remember it, you think of it, it actually grows. It's just like watering the flowers. Every time you remember to water them, they get more beautiful. Every time I remember to bow, I'm bowing to virtue. I worship virtue. Virtue is the harmlessness, it's the fearlessness. I'm not talking about me being fear, I mean me giving lack of fear to you. Talking about that in our retreat center. During the last retreat, first time we saw the kangaroos coming around to, you know, into the retreat center and John and Grove to start eating the grass around the stupas. Now they're usually in that part of the land, they're not used to human beings yet. So they used to run away, but now they're becoming tame. It has to happen. And the reason why is because they got nothing to fear by the people. We give them the gift of fearlessness. What a wonderful thing that is. I feel so sad for the animals because they hop around and they see this huge, powerful, big human being. We could do them a lot of damage. But we give them fearlessness. Little kangaroo, saw a little magpie today hopping between the chairs and the tables and the people at Bodhinyana Monastery. And it's hopping around like it owned the place, and people had to get out of the way. It's wonderful to see, because they had no fear of us. Isn't it wonderful to give the animals the gift of fearlessness? Little animal, little bird, you can fly wherever you want, and we'll protect you and care for you. So you don't have no fear at all from, you know, the monks or anyone else who visits Bodhinyana Monastery, and that's happening now in Jhana Grove. Isn't it wonderful if that happened in Perth? You can go to Northbridge for a nice evening out. You can go on maybe we should open up a monastery in Northbridge, so make it a nice safe place. So spread fearlessness throughout the whole area. Maybe instead of having security guards on the trains, we have monks on the trains and nuns to have fearlessness on the trains, so people can travel without any fear of being robbed or whatever. You know how wonderful it is to be able to walk somewhere and be totally safe? And have that fearlessness. So that's what the gift of virtue is. Virtue makes everyone feel so safe. You don't have to be afraid, you don't have to be on your guard. It's a beautiful gift which we can give by our virtue, our goodness. Because you all know you can come in here, you won't be harmed at all in this compound over here. That's a wonderful thing to say. You can come here and, you know, that people care for you and they protect you. So you get this beautiful sense of fearlessness. I remember some years ago, now somebody was just over there and they fell asleep during my talk and started snoring. Really snoring loudly. And somebody woke them up, and I told them off afterwards, you shouldn't wake them up like that. We found out afterwards that they were having this horrendous domestic violence. And they came here and they felt safe in this room. They felt so safe, they hadn't slept I don't know for how many days. You can imagine with domestic violence, even if, you know, it's not actually happening to you right now, the memory of it makes you so tense. You can't get a good night's sleep. When they came here, they felt so safe. It was the first time they'd slept in I don't know how long. And I said, let them sleep. So if anyone snores during one of my talks, well done, let them sleep. You don't know where they've come from. At least they've realized it feels a peaceful place and they're protected. They don't feel fear. And that's actually why they slept. We gave them the gift of fear. And that's more important than, you know, whatever you say with words, what you actually give. So virtue, that's why we worship. And that's my God, virtue, fearlessness, the gift of fearlessness to other people. Or the peace, that's my God. And actually, just if anyone wants to know what union with God is, what it feels like, you just make your mind so peaceful and so still that nothing moves. That's power. One of Ajahn Chah's sayings, those of you who come on my meditation retreats, you've heard me say this before. A powerful body comes from exercising it, running, jogging, whatever. a powerful mind comes from keeping it still. And that's incredibly true. You keep your mind still, peaceful, and you wouldn't believe the amount of power which comes into your mind. That's why I say remembering past lives or eons, that's a powerful mind. That comes only from stillness. Which means any of you say, yeah, I want that, want, that's not being still. You don't get anywhere that way. Wanting makes your mind move. Making peace keeps it still. And that stillness builds and builds, and that's huge power. So if you want to feel the power of deep meditation, it's a power which, you know, that Mahabharma feels. That's only the first jhana. You go far higher than that. But at least you get a taste of what it's like to be God. And all those Christian mystics who had union with God know exactly what that is. That's the first jhana experience. Stillness, powerful, you've disappeared. Your sense of self is gone. And his deep meditation, incredible bliss and power. And that's exactly what union with. I told people in the meditation retreat down at Serpentine last week. He said, look, some of you who did get jhanas, you know, you chose the wrong religion, because if you were Christian, you'd be a saint by now. And they'd name a hospital after you. But because you're a Buddhist, it's just first jhana, nothing much at all. But that's actually the experience which people have, is union with the powerful, which is the deep meditations. And that's what these Christian mystics were up to. But they called it union with God. So you can actually feel what that union with that Christian idea of God feels like. Incredible, powerful love, bliss, oneness. And that's a meditation experience. So, yeah, we understand what that is. That's actually even said in one of the Christian psalms. Be still and know that thou art God. That's in the Bible, in Psalms somewhere. I don't know where, but somewhere in Psalms. Be still. I remember asking a Catholic priest that, and he couldn't find it. He got very embarrassed. I said, look, it doesn't matter. You know, you can make mistakes. You don't have to be shown up by a Buddhist monk. I don't mind if you can't find it. So it's all right. So be still. Really still. I mean, big time still. I mean, you know, huge still. Awesomely still. And you can feel what a God, that power, that stillness and love really is. So you get to know what these things are. So I believe in that peace, and that's what I worship. And of course, the greatest one of all, wisdom and compassion. They all go together, because kindness is an obvious thing to do. It's wise. Forgiveness is part of compassion. Compassion and forgiveness are all part of wisdom. So to me, that's my God. That's what I believe in. That's what I worship. And that's what my friend Abbot Placid was confirming. What people are searching for in life, that is God. And what people are searching for? Peace, truth, love, freedom. I'm talking about real love. The ability to love yourself so much that you forgive everything. And you're totally at peace with yourself. Same way that a mother loves her child. Without criticism, without judgment, totally being at peace and accepting oneself for who you are. Not trying to be someone, not trying to put on some face, just being you. Happy, at peace, uncritical, unjudgmental, love. So that's what we worship. So that, to me, is what God is. So is Buddhism atheist? Stupid question. Depends what you mean by that God. The God I just finished with has said, yeah, I believe in that. So, you know, we believe in something. But it's not supernatural. Supernatural is something you just can't touch, you just can't reach. It's beyond nature. This is something which is natural, which is real, which you, anyone here can actually touch. Each one of you have touched a little bit of it. In Buddhism, we ask you to touch it more, to come closer to that, to make it grow, until it's just totally you. That you are peace, you are compassion, you are wisdom, you are truth. And that's what we mean by becoming enlightened. So this is what we believe in as Buddhists. So not the sense of a God up in the sky to be praised, to be worshipped and to be sort of asked for help. But truth, compassion, kindness, wisdom, virtue, which is right there in your heart, just need to tap into it. Not asking other people, for yourself. Self-responsibility. And you can understand why, that those people who follow this path are more likely to be ethical, kinder, and have more love. Which is why I think Buddhism is growing. Because it works. So that's the talk for this evening. Buddhism and atheism. So, has anyone got any comments or questions about this evening's little talk on atheistic Buddhism or God-believing Buddhism? And I do apologize for the joke. Okay, Eddie, I can't see any questions anymore. Yeah, Eddie. Yeah, except that the... But what I would say, I wouldn't say the kingdom of God lies within, the republic of truth lies within. Change it around a little bit to suit the modern times. Because all these kings and queens and stuff. So the republic of truth, of love, lies within you. It's much better. You know that other sort of joke, I told this at the Chinese Chamber of Commerce, I think, which was about 6 months ago. I said, you know, like, it also says in the Bible, it's a Christian Bible, you all know this, it's harder for a camel to pass through an eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. That's true, it's in there. It's harder for a camel to pass through an eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. And people, theologians, have discussed, what does it mean by, you know, to pass a camel through the eye of a needle? Whatever it means, everyone knows it's damn hard to do. Which means that, you know, if you're a rich man, it means it's even harder for you to get to heaven. So I mentioned that at the... Actually, somebody asked me to comment on that at the Chinese Chamber of Commerce. And I told them, look, we don't have that saying in Buddhism. So if you're a rich man or a rich woman, you've got a snowball's chance in hell of going to heaven as a Christian. But you can as a Buddhist. So rich people convert. It was a good line because in the WA Chinese Chamber of Commerce, lots of rich people there. It didn't work though. It was a good try. Only joking, of course. So thank you, Eddie. Yes.